Ms. Belk.
Good morning, Your Honor. Belinda Belk from Michael Beston Friedrich on behalf of the defendant Larry Hargrove. May it please the court. The Confrontation Clause guarantees that the accused shall have the right to confront the witnesses against him. That did not happen in this case. A government agent elicited testimony from Eddie Hicks, the star witness instrumental in obtaining Mr. Hargrove's conviction. Mr. Hargrove never got the opportunity to confront Eddie Hicks. In fact, Eddie Hicks poisoned this trial from beginning to end.
I'm a little puzzled by that. Wasn't Hicks on the stand?
Hicks was not on the stand. He is currently a fugitive from justice. He is in the trial from tape-recorded statements that he made with a confidential informant, Mr. Arthur Veal, wherein those in those transcripts, those 94 pages of transcripts and testimony of Mr. Hicks were never cross-examined. Their connection to Mr. Hargrove is unreliable. There are two very vague and tenuous connections to Hargrove in those statements, and based on that, this 94 pages of uncross-examined testimonial testimony came before the court.
For me, Ms. Belk, it would be very helpful if you could reconcile your interpretation of Crawford with our statement in Jenkins that Crawford did not change the rules as to the admissibility of co-conspirator statements.
Yes, Your Honor. First, the first most important distinction is where these statements were taken. In Jenkins, it is two co-conspirators casually talking amongst themselves, whereas here in the case before the court, this is a confidential informant having a discussion where he is sent in to elicit testimony from Mr. Hicks. And secondly, Jenkins was decided before Davis v. Washington, and here is where Davis v. Washington, under the Supreme Court's recent position in Davis v. Washington, that this comes under the definition of testimonial, because what Davis did is it refocused the debate on whether you have to look at what the primary purpose of the statement was in an interrogation situation. And while Davis took in this post-Crawford world and tried to begin to identify what is testimonial versus non-testimonial.
I'm lost now. The basis of the co-conspirator exception to the hearsay rule doesn't have anything to do with testimonial. It's a theory of agency, that every co-conspirator is an agent for everyone else, and so therefore it is the defendant's own statement. Now, does anything in Crawford call into question the agency basis of this very old rule?
No, Your Honor, but what Crawford does tell us is that the old rule...
It's the defendant's own statement. It doesn't matter whether it's testimonial or not.
Well, here, what makes this testimonial is that...
If it's the defendant's own statement, it doesn't matter whether it's testimonial or not, right?
Well, under Davis v. Washington, statements that could be normally considered non-testimonial in other situations, even though they are admitted...
You can't answer my question by going back to your argument that here's the reason why it's testimonial. I'm trying to get you to deal with the question whether it matters whether it's testimonial, given the basis of the co-conspirator exception to the hearsay rule.
Well, what Crawford also tells us is that the Confrontation Clause will not be satisfied just by so designations under the modern rules of hearsay evidence, simply because the modern rules of hearsay evidence have...
Counsel, I think you're still missing the point. It's an admission. So you're arguing that he should have been permitted to confront himself?
I do understand the point, but in this situation, I think that the court also needs to look at the Confrontation Clause is not being confronted with himself, but he's being confronted with a co-conspirator whose testimony was elicited by a confidential informant. It wasn't the co-conspirator statement. It lends itself to that you want co-conspirators casually talking where you have those statements on record, not a confidential informant who's going in to purposely poke and prod and question to get testimony that can bear witness at trial. That is the situation we're dealing with. And even if this court does find that it is non-testimonial.
Now it sounds like you're saying it wasn't co-conspirator testimony at all because it wasn't in furtherance of the conspiracy. Is that your argument?
No, it was admitted under a co-conspirator statement, exception, hearsay exception.
I know that was the ground of its admission. Are you conceding that that is correct?
Yes, Your Honor. But it was his statements, but the format that they were taken and the format that they were used at trial, they became testimonial.
Then I'm just lost. I mean, it looks to me that you might have had an argument that this was not in the course of and in furtherance of the conspiracy. But if you're not making that argument, then it's admitted on an agency theory, which leads, of course, to the fact, as my colleague said, that it's an admission. And then it doesn't matter whether it's testimonial or not.
Well, then I would submit to this court that these statements were not, and I take my previous statement that they were co-conspirator statements.
Your brief doesn't make that argument. Was there any objection at trial that the requirements of the co-conspirator doctrine were not satisfied?
There were not any objections at trial. There are objections to these statements coming in that were made over and over again. In the proffer, the Santiago proffer that happened early in the pleadings, the co-conspirator statement elements were laid out at that point. And then at that point, they also said that there needs to be no indicia of reliability analysis that the court needs to go through, which also leads me to that if this court does find that they are considered non-testimonial, that there were no guarantees of trustworthiness. And in this post-Crawford and post-Davis world...
To the theory of co-conspirator hearsay. The defendant can't say, my own statements weren't reliable because I'm an inveterate liar.
Well, here these were statements of what a confidential informant came in and interrogated.
No, but... That's what it means for A to be an agent of B. A's statements are attributed to B. You can't ever, forget Crawford, you can't say this co-conspirator statement can't be admitted because either I'm a liar or my co-conspirators are a bunch of liars. It's not a theory under which there's any problem with admission.
I would submit to this court that under Davis, that what is testimonial, non-testimonial, can be altered based on the vehicle at which it is used. And when you have a confidential informant who was sent in to basically elicit testimony, to that this witness then becomes a witness to bear witness at trial. And that's what Eddie Hicks did. It was never cross-examined. And its connection to Mr. Hargrove was never, ever tested either. There are two very vague references that could possibly relate to Hargrove or anyone else. Based on those two very vague references, all of this testimony and live video and tape recordings came before the jury. This is a harmful error that severely prejudiced my client's rights.
Ms. Belk, what is your best evidence that Mr. Hargrove disavowed the conspiracy? I understand that he moved away, but what other?
Well, he left the force in 2000, and then he basically, based on the record, he told all of the alleged people who were involved and named in the trial that he was gone, that he had moved across country, and that puts him out of the conspiracy if he was so involved in the conspiracy.
What about that evidence that he still received payments from subsequent raids? Would that indicate...
I'm not aware on the record of where he received payments post him moving to... That's one of the vague references in the transcripts that they would possibly give him a cut.
Right.
But there's no evidence in the record to support that payments were ever made, because those actions that were taken afterward in those raids and those houses was actually government money, so that there were no payments sent to him after that point that he moved to Nevada if he was a part of this conspiracy.
Thank you.
And then also this trial. There's another crucial piece of evidence that this trial entered into evidence, and that was an improper lineup. And an improper lineup can become a violation of the right to due process when there's a substantial...
Pre-trial motion to exclude this evidence?
No, there was not, Your Honor.
Well, Rule 12b-3c and e say that you can raise this kind of issue only by pre-trial motion.
I would say that this is under the plain error standard, that it was not waived but forfeiture.
Does not apply to this. That's the holding of United States against Frady. The cause and prejudice standard is the standard that governs failure to make such a motion. And I certainly didn't see in your brief any cause and prejudice argument.
I would say that he was severely prejudiced by this improper lineup because it was patently and unduly suggestive on its face and under the totality of the circumstances, unreliable. I will reserve my time for rebuttal.
The problem is cause, not prejudice. Thank you, Ms. Belk. Mr. Pasquale.
May it please the Court, Counsel. My name is Morris Pasquale, and I represent the United States on this appeal.
Mr. Pasquale.
Yes, Judge.
Other than the statements by Hicks in the tapes, what was the strongest evidence against Mr. Hargrave?
Judge, this was a four-man ripoff crew consisting of two active Chicago Police Department sergeants, Eddie Hicks and Larry Hargrove, and two other individuals, Matthew Moran, who was a friend of Hicks, and also Lawrence Nitter, who was a CPD auto mechanic who posed as a policeman. Both Nitter and Moran pled guilty at the trial and testified to what approached almost, I believe, close to three dozen separate ripoffs between 1992 and a all-sub incident in April of 1999. So you had two of the four members of the crew provided firsthand information on dozens of ripoffs, and in each of those dozens of ripoffs, they stated that both Hicks and Hargrove was present. So that, of course, was very probative. You had the references on tapes where Hicks is talking about Hicks now after Arthur Veal, who was a person that Hargrove and Hicks had dealt with before Veal became a cooperator. Now Veal is cooperating, and he's proposing another ripoff scenario. And even though Hargrove has retired, he did nothing to disavow, and of course the law is mere cessation of activity is not enough to constitute withdrawal from a conspiracy. So you have conversations on tape where Hicks is saying, yeah, for this new deal with Veal, my guy, the one guy moved, he retired. One guy, he actually comes out and says, my guy retired and he moved to Las Vegas.
Is he the only one that moved away?
Yes, Hicks was still in Chicago, Moran was still in Chicago, Nitter was still in Chicago. And of course, during this period, the record, the evidence of trial showed a large volume of phone calls between Hicks and the Hargrove Hope telephone number in Nevada. As Your Honors have already identified, the issue here is this is not a Crawford issue. These are co-conspirator statements. They're admissions, which are not testimonial, and that's what Jenkins says. The fact that Hicks was talking to Veal does not take it outside the realm of those cases. Hicks did not believe he was talking to Veal as a government agent, a known police agent. He thought he was talking to Veal in furtherance of the conspiracy in order to execute, in order to plan the next ripoff. So what happened here is light years away from anything that even might remotely be construed as what Crawford recognizes as testimonial. These were garden variety co-conspirator statements which were properly admitted by Judge Anderson. With respect to the issue of the photo array, counsel has forfeited that claim of error, and as we recite in our brief, even under a plain error analysis.
Why does your brief ignore Rule 12b-3c, Rule 12e, and Frady?
Because of an oversight by myself.
The reason the Solicitor General went to the Supreme Court in Frady was that the D.C. Circuit had applied plain error analysis to this.
I understand, Your Honor.
The Solicitor General argued, and the Supreme Court held, that was much too favorable to defendants.
And I overlooked that, Your Honor. I apologize. But counsel has not shown plain error at all, much less a plain error, for the reasons stated in our brief. So unless there are questions on that, I'll ask Your Honors to affirm both the conviction and sentence of the defendant.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ms. Pasquale. Ms. Belk, we asked you a lot of questions, so I'll give you 1 minute for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor, what Mr. Pasquale just said, the tape said, my guy. That is exactly what did not happen in closing statements in this case. He didn't say my guy. He said Eddie Hicks told you. He got up there. You heard Eddie Hicks tell you. And this is not a co-conspirator statement. This is more akin to an interrogation by an agent of the law enforcement here. And when you look at Jenkins, if you're relying on Jenkins, Jenkins predates Davis, went through a different analysis to define testimonial. One, that it's a non-emergency situation, that the primary purpose of which was to prove past events and for the purpose to prove a conviction at trial. That's exactly the case we have here. We have a government agent that was sent into the field to elicit testimony so that Hicks could bear testimony against Mr. Hargrove to prove and establish past events. That is the case that we have here today. Mr. Hargrove never had the opportunity for a fair trial. He never had the opportunity to confront the witnesses against him. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ms. Bell. And we appreciate your willingness to take the appointment in this case and the assistance both you and your law firm have been to the defendant. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will be in recess until tomorrow.